afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to welcome you today to my Saturday afternoon with Carolyn. It's October 11th, 2014 already, and I'm Carolyn Yeager, enjoying a cool, cloudy day after a night of rain. What more could I ask? The days are certainly getting shorter. I've noticed that. And in fact, it's getting close to Halloween. Wow. So to start out today, I want to thank Jaime Schwartz for his donation. It was very nice to see that I had something in the P.O. box and went there, and it was from Jaime, our good friend, and he's still supporting me in these programs. So thank you, Jaime, and hope all is well with you and you're doing real well health-wise, you, both you and your wife. I also want to celebrate today another little celebration of my reaching the 400 mark on my website, carolynyeager.net, as to visits. Well, this is according to the Globe. I'm never sure about this Globe, but I don't want to go and figure it all out from the, or try to figure it out, which I don't know if I could do, from the server stats, because I know I got a new server and did a lot of different things since I started this site. So, but the Globe has always been running, so I'm just going with that. But it did cross the 400 mark on for the 3 years that I've been, it's just about the same time as the 3 year anniversary came up. And this was on Thursday, October 9th, sometime in the afternoon. And now it's at 401,083 right at this moment. So that's just a little something I thought I'd mention since I had commented on it, that I was waiting to hit that 400,000 mark. Of course, I realize there are websites that have 400,000 visits a day. Wow. Takes me 3 years, but okay, that's all right. I'm not one of those websites. And I will say that my traffic continues to do very well, and I've the increases remain, and it's moving. I have a lot more visitors than when I started, that's for sure, and it's continued to grow. So that's all one can ask, and it's all I ask. Let me take this site down and continue on. I was also going to say about my site, yeah, one more thing, that, you know, I have this list of most popular articles on the front page, and I had that idea to do that, and I'm really glad I did, and Bill Fink put it together, and he made it better than I thought it could be, because it automatically keeps up with itself and, you know, goes by the most the highest viewed articles, and well, it would be anything just about, I think, but nothing else gets that high. So on my site, and I thought it would stay pretty much the same, but boy, there have been it has just having them there, I think, has caused attention to these articles. And the one I do remember, Fake Legends of Adolf Hitler's Jewish Grandfather, Why They're Not True, or something like that is the whole title of it. But I think it was at 126,000 when I started, and it's gone up to 132,000, which I didn't really think it could go much higher, but has gone up that much. That's about 6,000 reads or views since I did that. But what's really the other things have moved around a lot. Sometimes it stayed the same for a long time, and I thought, well, this is not going to. I look at the numbers, you know, some of them were close together. I thought, well, this one might pass up this one in front of it. But I thought some would never move up that far. But the one that suddenly has, several of them have, but the number two most popular has been the man who might have been Führer, about Hans Ulrich Rudel, which was at about 49 and 50,000 when I started this. Now it's at 58,700 something. Oh, I've got that. I wrote that down wrong. I think it's 492. But suddenly in the last month or so, I maybe started sooner than that, this article from Ein Anderer Hitler by Hermann Giesler, The One Fateful Decisions, about the Hitler talking about his reasons for his invasion of both Poland and the Soviet Union, has really gone up ahead. And I was quite amazed when I saw that it was right under the Rudel article, which has always been popular, and I thought it would always stay at number two. See how I think things? I don't. it passed it up. It's passed up Rudel, and it's at number two now, this one, Fateful Decisions, 63,297. So it went up from around 18 or something. 18,000 or 20,000 maybe, you know, in the low 20,000s when I started put this list up. And so it just, I must have gotten on some forums or some groups that are linking to it, and lots of people are going to it. So that's very good, because I like to have Ein Anderer Hitler read and recognized by more people, more than it has been. So that makes me very happy. And I was going to read from that article last Monday when I was doing the program about the Slavs. And then Marcus called, and I realized right away that was more interesting, what we were discussing, than for me to read something. And then Bob called, and so that was that worked out better. I thought, well, I could still do this. And I do intend to continue with the Slav subject on Monday. I was going to do it today, and I thought, no, I want to wait until Monday so that it will be on the Heretics Hour again. So, you know, when people are looking at the Heretics Hour, they'll see these shows that are related to one another, instead of having to jump all over, you know, the board. Because while the shows might seem the same to me, people, they are separated in the archives. And so... So therefore, I'm planning on that, and I'm going to talk, I found that material on Serbia and World War One that I was, I didn't find that particular material, but I found something else that's good. So I'm going to cover those things on Monday. So I decided today that I would just do this and that things that I would like to comment on. And so I've ended up with three main topics, which I put on the program post and on the program announcement. And it wasn't easy to write what I wrote, and I kind of want to apologize to I feel like I should somewhat apologize to Robert Stark for using that picture of him. But when I went to his found his radio blog, which I may have seen before. I think I did, but I'd forgotten about it in the meantime, and I found it again. And I saw that picture of him where he talks, when he says words under about him. I was so struck by that picture. I thought, wow, I just want to use that picture. And, you know, I want to say right up front that I don't have anything, personal against Robert Stark. He's always been polite and considerate, and he's never bothered me. And I don't mean to be bothering him, but it just so happens that he is part of the topic, and he's also hosting this radio program that's coming up, so-called debate. So he's in the program today, and I thought, well, I think it's important that that picture be seen. So when I get to that, we have a little more to say about that. You know, I do things a lot that I'm, I feel a little concerned, but afterwards I think that I was perfectly right, and I'm sure I'm going to think that this time too. So, you'll have to wait and see what some of these comments that I have. And I do welcome callers, but let me get a little way into this, first, but, the phone number is 323-642-1206. Somehow those numbers just don't flow off my tongue. I kind of get, they hard for me to say. 642 1206. All right. I'm going to say a little word about Obamacare to start, because I feel like I have plenty of time today, although I don't know. I hope I get my last thing read. I have some good stuff at the end. I've been wanting to mention this for weeks now, it never fits in. But speaking about Obamacare, I came upon, this is what made me think about it, I came upon a table that somebody posted about the breakdown of prescriptions and comparing them with the what the employer pays and what the public exchange subsidized cost is. I assume that's what, if you have signed up for Obamacare medical treatment or something, or health insurance, I mean, you get this subsidized one. I don't know about employer pay, but it says, people with jobs who are probably married, probably with children. Anyway, people with jobs is A, and people without jobs is B, and, you know, the one is a whole lot more expensive than the other one, or the other way around, is it? The one that people pay themselves, yeah, the people with jobs pay a lot more, and the people without jobs, because they're being subsidized and so on, pay the other. But my experience with Obamacare, which I thought I wouldn't have any, but I did, it has affected me as far as the prescription that I take, and I only take one. It's not a drug. It's a natural ingredient, but because it's effective as a drug, you have to get a prescription from a doctor. And so this thing, though, I do need is for my thyroid. And so I had started taking the generic type rather than the name brand type, and it was like a one third as much or so. And doing fine. Its price has gone up some, but that's because I've been taking it. The strength of it went up two different times. But this last time I went to get some, what I was used to paying was like 20 some dollars for the 90 day supply, and it was over $50. And I was so shocked, you know. And I said, $50? Why is it, you know, are you sure? Why did it go up so much? Well, she seemed unconcerned, the woman in the pharmacy, but she said, I don't know, you know. And I said, well, that doesn't seem right, you know, because for it to go up that much, I wasn't thinking about Obamacare, even though I had read about all these dangerous things that were going to be happening. Anyway, she looked it up, and she told me what I had paid last time, which was in the low 20s, and then what this was, and the same one, you know, same generic. I said, what's the name brand? Well, it was three times. It was over 150 or something like that. You know, I mean, it was way up there. I thought, well, I don't have any choice here, do I? I have to have this. So as I was going through the payment process, I said, why do you think that went up so much? And she just looked at me and said with a straight face, Obamacare. And I suppose she shouldn't have said that, so she didn't, you know, but she did say it to me. She did tell me that, which was nice. And I thought, oh, I knew right away that's what it was. I thought, wow. So I got hit with Obamacare, too. Not so bad, but it's really, there's no, you know, there's no explanation for why something would, double, or just a little bit, over double, in a few months. And that is the explanation that I have to pay more. So now I want to go on to a Moscow update. I seem to be writing more and more about Moscow and Putin. And, I got this from, where's this one from? Oh, I got both of these the Goebel, Paul Goebel, from Paul Goebel's site, blog site. Well, I think he's got some interesting things there. And there's two little items I want to mention. One is that a Russian human rights activist, Elena Vasilyeva. Now, I realize we don't like these human rights activists here, but somehow I see it differently when I think about Russia. So she has come out and said that she hears from a lot of mothers, and she says that as many as 1,600 Russian servicemen have died in the Donbas fighting since the Minsk Accords, which were on September 5th. That's quite a lot. We don't hear about any of that, so I don't know, but she had a press conference in Kharkiv, what we used to call Kharkov, but now they spell it Kharkiv. And she said that, quoting her, mothers who have buried their soldier children have written her organization with a request to talk about how their children died. She's not just a rights activist. She's a part of this organization that they have there in Russia. And she said on the basis of those letters, rather than on Russian official documents, she bases her estimate. Well, of course, I wouldn't. It's maybe you could say 1,000. If she's saying 1,600, you might be safer to say around 1,000. But even so, if it's that is a lot. If there are Russians who have died in Ukraine, Russian soldiers, that's a high number. And there's a big talk about that, continues to be circulating among people and stories about that these mothers tell of how they got their son back in a coffin and what they were told. So also yesterday he wrote about the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kiev Patriarchate, you know, like from patriarchy, but it's Patriarchate, which is I looked that up. Well, that's the highest that's like a bishop in the Orthodox Church. Okay, and then he has his own area that he's the bishop over, and that's the Patriarchate. And he said, and he's also called that, I guess, and he said that the Russian special services, that is Russian intelligence, are planning provocations against the denomination, his denomination, on October 14th, coming up in a few days. A reminder, if one is in need, that Vladimir Putin is following the Soviet provocation model, first developed by Cheka founder Felix Dzerzhinsky. Well, I know I have a lot of you out there who totally pro-Russian, and you think this is, I'm probably just following some anti-Russian information here. Well, maybe. I'm just going to tell you, though, what it is. And he said, he wrote that since 1917, the Soviet and now Russian intelligence officials have specialized in provocations, posing as supporters of the most anti-Soviet and anti-Russian groups, and thus recruiting and ultimately discrediting the latter by prompting them to make statements or take actions that undermine their standing with their traditional supporters. Well, this is what's always being said about the CIA, that the CIA is doing this, and we seem to only hear that it's the CIA is busy undermining the ones that they want to undermine in this way. But I talked about before, Russian intelligence is more advanced, I think, than the CIA. They've had excellent intelligence all the way back to the Tsars, and they still have it. And so, you know, they're doing things, you know, a lot of things, a lot of stuff that looks natural, or, oh, this is just, you know, Russian television or whatever, that intelligence is involved in that. So it goes on to say that Russian intelligence services have been using this strategy of provocations for some time in Ukraine, sending in people who pose as the most anti-Kremlin activists imaginable, encouraging them to issue statements or take actions that discredit Ukraine And then sitting back as other Ukrainians and more important media in other countries blame Ukrainians for what the Russians are doing. Well, that's the end of that. But we do have to remember that we're getting propaganda from both sides in this, and it's not just coming from one side. So we gotta watch out for getting into this, you know, the good and the bad, the black and the white, kind of thinking. That we got to take a side, and when we get on our side, then we have to, you know, be like we're cheering for a football team. I mean, we only want to win, and we don't think about all the. It's not a football game, you see. We don't think about all the elements that might be working in a bad way for our future. So now to my topic. Well, my first topic. I just mentioned this debate, but it's really about, white nationalism and, that's actually my second one. My first and second one go together, but, you know, talking again about, can we unite white people? And there's been so much talk about it and so much, written about it lately. It's been so in the news in the white news that I don't think I need to go into all kinds of introduction as to who's saying what. I'll just jump right in and say that, I'm going to talk about this debate. Not that it bothers me or I really care about this debate, but it brings up an interesting group of people. So, and Robert Stark, I discovered, just recently is Jewish. I may have heard it, I didn't know for sure, but, Robert himself says that he's Jewish. And so now he may have said that before, but it just came to my attention. And the thing is, I suspect he's homosexual too. And it brings to mind, Voice of Reason, and his great popularity there with Mike Connor, and how Mike Connor was so anxious to push, Robert Stark forward. And a lot of people were, you know, kind of enjoyed Robert, but also sort of made fun of him and sort of made jokes about him, but they kind of liked him too. And then he went over to Counter Currents. And he was very associated with Greg Johnson for quite a while. And I don't know if he's still, if his programs are still posted there. I would think so. But he also has, his own, as I already mentioned, his own, site, and it's called, robertstarkradio.com. I'm pretty sure. In my comment section, the program that I did, about Hitler, I don't have that information here either, but it was, probably a Saturday program, a couple weeks ago, or a week ago, maybe. Oh, I don't know. I shouldn't have closed that page. I'm going to go back to it now so I don't keep getting irritating myself here with not knowing what I'm talking about. Okay, this program was on Saturday, October 4th. Today's the 11th. That was last Saturday. I wasn't sure if I did a program last Saturday. I don't think so. Because I had that anniversary thing, that was time. I'm behind time. So there were a lot of comments to that program because it was called Where, Oh, Where is White Nationalism Going? And it included, you know, whether Hitler should be, you know, the attacks on National Socialism by so many white nationalists. So, in those comments, Robert Stark, replied to someone who had written, for someone from GermanVictims.com website had written that, written this, warning, Jewishness is in the blood. So we should remember the 2,000 plus year old skills of the Jews to make themselves likable so they can overcome us, circumcised or not, Catholic or not. A Jew is always a trickster by blood. That was the point here. In two places, this person wrote, it's in the blood. It's in the blood. And I said the nicest ones are the best tricksters, and linked to an article. But Robert Stark, who never commented here, although he has commented, when I was when we still had the White Network going, he wrote there at least one time that I remember. You know, but generally he doesn't. I never comment to him, and he doesn't to me. But he wrote a really nice or decent comment then. But he wrote here in answer to this, it's cultural. I am of that ancestry myself, so I have credentials to speak on it. Well, I noticed that, I can tell you. I didn't respond to it because I really didn't know, have anything particular to say except, oh, really, or whatever. But a couple people did. But anyway, that Robert Stark is admitting, and maybe he has been all along for all I know, that he's of the Jewish ancestry. So that is the first thing here. And so I went over there to his site, and but only for this program, not before. I didn't do it at that time. I was too busy. But I listened to a couple of his interviews, and I thought maybe I had read some positive things on his about page from that people had written in. I thought, well, he's really developed, I guess, into a good interviewer. But he sounded exactly the same as he always had. You know, not changed a bit, but a lot of people seem to like that because he just blurts out with things, and it ends up often making for a good program, and brings out some good things from the person he's interviewing. So it works, even though it's not considered the way to do a good interview. However, I saw, of course, all the ones that the people I recognize. But I looked at to see what kind of people he was interviewing. And it's the same thing, you know, as always, like it was back on at Voice of Reason. All kinds of different people, irregardless of what their race is, or their ethnicity, or their religion, or anything else, you know. It's just he thinks there's somebody that would be, you know, would be interesting, or that at least is available to him, well, he goes and does it. And one of the people that he's recently interviewed is Joaquin Flores, who's supposedly a spokesman for New Resistance, and he runs the Center for Syncretic Studies, and he's a member of the Serbian Radical Party. So that interested me because I've been talking about the Serbs lately, and so I thought, well, I wonder. And one of the topics that he has listed there, and he lists a lot of topics, just about everything they go to talk about, is why this Flores chose Serbia as his center of operation. So I tried to find. I started to listen to it. I just couldn't get interested. You know, it was hard for me to have it on, and so I wanted to do other things. So I moved ahead, and I tried to find this part where he talks about Serbia, and I heard some. He thought that it doesn't matter what he thought, really, because that's not the topic of my show tonight. But I thought that he was not very, that this man was not very, he didn't present himself too well. He was not very eloquent as a speaker. He said, you know, quite a lot, too much, you know, too much. So he didn't sound like he really was had a grasp of everything he was doing, but he liked to talk, and he liked to say, tell all the things that he had done and his experiences and so on, and give theories. It was heavy on theory. of what should happen, and he was definitely considered himself a revolutionary, and he's supposedly is for a left and a right alliance, a left-right alliance against the plutocracy, you know, he's one, that kind of thing, you know, that he started off on the radical left. Anyway, he supposedly, one of the topics here is European nationalism and the new right. Actually, I don't know what he said about that, but, you know, this strikes me as this kind of confused, well, I'll say confused, people in the right who are different, you know, and new right, and they have to have a different kind of an angle, and they're all kinds of people, just like we're getting on the Voice of Reason network whether they're anarchists or left wingers and non-white people every kind of thing, you know, but they have some kind of connection with the right, because they don't like the ruling powers, you know. If you don't like the ruling powers, then it's kind of like, well, we can all join together against the ruling powers. And this is a long about way to say that, what kind of the theme of this show today, from my point of view, is that I don't think we can all join together against what we see as a common enemy that idea is so prevalent in not only here with this kind of a man, this Flores, or with in white and more strict and what we're used to thinking of as white nationalist circles, that the more of us there are, the better, and so we need to join together. And so you find someone like Robert Stark interviewing all these different people. And there are a lot of different people he's interviewing, and they're not at all similar, you know, and they don't come hardly from the same place, and they have different perspectives, and some of them are just talking about not some big movement, but some other interests that they have or things that they've written or whatever. But, I mean, it's just, it's kind of what a lot of people think is very, very good, and actually that's why you have networks. I guess that's a lot of the radio networks are thinking, well, we present, we have a lot of different hosts and they can present something, you know, they all come from their own perspective or their own tastes. And so the listeners get a choice and some might like one and some might like another. And, that is looked upon as good media, I would say. But at the same time, it's more of an entertainment, although entertainment, information, and education venue, but without a really strong perspective or point of view. And when Robert was talking to Luke Ford, I listened to his interview with Luke Ford, and I found that a lot more enjoyable. I actually found Luke Ford to be a good person to listen to, found favor with me as far as just his ability to express himself very well and say things that were interesting, whether I agreed with him or not. So, see, where was I going with that? I don't know. I lost my track there, but it was simply there's no philosophy. Robert Stark. He has no philosophy definite of his own. He said to Luke Ford that he didn't consider himself a part of any movement. He considered himself a seeker of the truth. He just wanted to find out what was the truth. So he thought if you listen to enough people, you'll find the truth. Well, I can't say I agree with that. It sounds like a good theory. But if you listen to a lot of people, you can just keep hearing different points of view and not being able to make up your mind or not being able to know which one is better than the other. And the last person you listen to has the strongest influence on your mind until you go listen to or read something else. So eventually, yeah, I think people, and we all have to, and a movement, something that would be a movement, has to work its way to what it thinks is right and what it doesn't, and just let go of all the rest, because you can't just keep entertaining everything in your mind. So that brings me to well, I'll say a little bit more here. I've got, this is below here, but I've got this information here, a few notes. That since I mentioned the Luke Ford interview by Robert Stark, you know, I noticed that there was a lot of talk about sex. Of course, this Ford is supposedly was a student of sexual neuroticism and amongst Jews but amongst others, everybody, kind of Freudian, kind of looking at things according to, and he talks a lot about addictions that we're just not, we're not very healthy, and how to get more healthy. And he's worked on all these things and in 12-step programs and so on, and what all these addictions do to us and where they come from, growing up. Well, I do think that's where they come from, but while he was doing that, and Stark was really enjoyed hearing about anything sexual, I noticed. And they would, you know, Stark would have a little giggle. There was nothing, you know, awful about it. It's just, you know, it was in the stuff that Luke Ford did. And so there was a lot of talk about it. And I thought it showed, you know, quite a bit of, comfort and, with sexualizing things quite a bit. And at one point, he talked about, Isla Vista and being a hypersexualized environment. And it was more things about sex there. And then Cedars-Sinai Hospital was mentioned by Luke Ford. And then Stark said, I was born there, actually. I was actually born there. And they just said Cedars-Sinai, but I figured that was the hospital they meant. And so then Ford says, just very casually, to Stark, and he's very composed and casual and low key, this Ford, which is what makes it nice to listen to him. When I say nice, I mean, you know, it's not it doesn't irritate, you know, or turn you off and say, I can't listen to this anymore, which so many radio shows do. And he asked Stark, though, right then, if he was circumcised, because he was born at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. Yes. And Stark was silent for a bit, and then he recovered, and he sort of laughed, and he says, no, actually not, and then went on. See, I thought, if he's Jewish and he was born at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, he probably was, but he doesn't want to admit that. See, I don't know for a fact, but I just thought that was a kind of interesting part of the program. And then, this Luke Ford had some interesting things to say about Holocaust denial, and he said it was actually about attacking this, it was not really about the numbers and so on, but it was about attacking this Jewish moral superiority that he appears to be admitting, and that Jews have managed to be treated in a special way because of it. And that's really what the Holocaust revisionists object to, is this status that Jews have attained from the Holocaust. And that's why we want to deny it, but we actually want to show that it's not true. But he seems to maybe think that it is, but that he understands Holocaust denial because he agrees with the Jewish moral superiority, that white people wouldn't like it and Europeans wouldn't like it. So that's what's really behind it all. I actually found that interesting. It wasn't offensive at all. There's nothing that this Luke Ford says that's really offensive. But you see, he's Jewish, and he's become, I think, an Orthodox Jew now, because he's he has a beard, or at least I think the beard is the recent pictures of him. I'm not sure. But I thought that he is actually quite intelligent. And so there's going to be this debate. I don't know how it got set up, but it's scheduled for Tuesday, this coming Tuesday at 8 p.m. and moderated by Robert Stark on his Stark Truth Radio. Oh, that's what it's called, Stark Truth Radio. Oh, that's Stark Truth. Yeah, he was always, the StarkTruthRadio.com is his website. And it's going to be simulcast on the American Nationalist Network at Blog Talk, because Rodney is going to be debating Luke Ford on the question, are Jews good for Western civilization? Well, the only thing I'll say that while Rodney will have the point that white people, white nationalists, most white nationalists would agree with, probably, I can't imagine he could, he would look too good compared to this Luke Ford. So for that reason, I'm planning on listening to it. I think it should be interesting. See how Robert Stark moderates it. So you've got two Jews here, and Rodney is involving himself with. When Rodney is complaining to other people about other people involving themselves with Jews. It's just quite amazing, you know, how he does these things. But he's and then the points about this program, they're all so, I mean, you know the answer already, you know. Has cooperation with Jews been a positive for ethno-nationalists in Europe? Well, I suppose that Luke Ford will have some yes to that and have some argument, so that might be all right. But most of these things, the decision is already made in people's minds, so there's not much point in debating it, and debates don't accomplish much. It's been created, and I will just wait to see what other people have to say about it after it takes place. And I want to say a little bit more about Rodney Martin, but first, I want to mention that why do I have this stuff here? I don't know why I have the, I think I'm out of order a little bit here. Item one, say as to why Rodney Martin would be doing this debate, I don't know if he was asked by them to do it, but I did listen to his show with I think his name is Charles Lincoln. Rodney had a program with Charles Lincoln. That was the intellectual to whom Rodney told him that he had graduated Phi Beta Kappa and summa cum laude, because this man kept talking about the intellectual wing and dealing with the intellectuals and so on. And I think maybe Rodney Martin felt a little like he was not being included, so he had to say that. And that's why I have this here, because I'm going to speak a little bit about that. But in this program, this Charles Lincoln was kind of in a slow and easy way, wanting to encourage white Holocaust revisionists to talk to Jews who were, he said, were also Holocaust revisionists, basically, and they were in complete agreement about a lot of points about the Holocaust, and I'm aware that there are such people, but they never go all the way. But and then he finally came up with the name, guess who? Gilad Atzman. So I said, oh, that's what he has in mind, you know, the Gilad Atzman thing, where there's both, you know, the good Jews and the Paul Eisen, where they're going to say, oh yeah, well, we can really get together on this. But there's a lot that they will leave out that they won't get together with, or that I think is a part of it. So this is where all this is going. It can seem like it's presented as we need to all get along and we need to come to some agreements and stop this fighting, and we've got good Jews here who want to help us do this. You know, it is another way to take charge of the revisionist movement and to what you call gatekeeping, let it go so far and no further, and get rid of all the people who are too extreme, are too much Holocaust deniers, and change the whole thing. I see that is what it's all about. So I don't see any point in doing this, getting together with these people like Atzmon. I would be opposed to that. And so I imagine Luke Ford would be for it also, and this Charles and Charles Lincoln. I'm sure they worked together, and they were working together with Tom Sunick. It's all tied in, and now Rodney Martin's in the middle of this. But he thinks that he's going to argue against it, probably. I don't know how well he'll do, but we could say why does he do it? I say desire for recognition. What's pushing Rodney Martin is less a desire for truth or to find truth than probably Robert Stark is more interested in truth than Rodney Martin. Rodney Martin is interested in recognition and wanting to be seen as a leader or a leading personality, wanting to be taken seriously, like when he's among what he considers the intellectuals, he wants to be seen as an intellectual, all of that. And because talking about addictions and problems that we get from growing up, he's got a few. You know, we all have some, but you know, he has a need to show that he's accomplished things. He has a need to show that he's a man of accomplishment, and that's another what it's also behind that having to have an organization that he runs. And he started out with this Worldview Foundations. He said it was going to be a foundation, and from what somebody out there says, that it's never been registered as a foundation. Hi there, everyone. Am I here? Looks like I'm here. My mic is red. All right. Well, what happened was I just got disconnected from Skype and, went offline. It quit working. But I couldn't call in on Skype right away, so I was trying that direct thing, for a while, but that wasn't working. And it's a good thing because then they came back on, the little Skype button came back up on my page. On my studio page, so I could use it, and I've recalled. So here I am. Wow, that's a strange thing to happen. But I know it happens to other people. It just doesn't happen to me enough that I'm aware of what is the best thing to do, because that's the Skype call wasn't appearing on my studio page right away, and so I didn't think I could do it. But then I saw. After I was working on the Direct Connect, which I don't like, I saw it there again. So, all right. So once again, this is Carolyn Yeager. We're at Saturday afternoon and coming up on the first hour. And here I'm taking so long to say all this stuff that I'm not so far ahead as I thought I would be. So since we had that darn blank spot, I'm not going to play any music for the mid-hour break, so mid-show break. So I'm going to just continue. And I was, I think that I was, let's see, I want somebody to write to me at my Carolyn Yeager at carolyn@carolynyeager.net and tell me that I've... that you're hearing me, just so I can be sure that I'm being heard. But in the meantime, I heard a funny sound, but okay. I was saying that, and I was getting to my point here, that I think I was. Let me find my place again. Okay, that, yeah, that, oh, I was talking about addictions and that what we, how we need to achieve things. Some people need to achieve things and to be seen as achievers because there were experiences of rejection in their, childhood, infancy, early life, and so on. And that's basically what's behind that. I want to say that, in spite of that, in spite of everybody's needs, and you can sympathize with people for what they need and what they want, it is still that if we're interested in finding the truth, and we have to understand that that truth for Jews is different than truth for Germans, and they're of a different spirit. And Jews are trapped in this sexuality that I was that I mentioned earlier, and sexualizing everything. And they bring that into their relations and into their mixing in with I'm not going to use the word Gentiles, and I am going to use the word Germans, even if some people feel like that's not the right. I could use the word Aryans. Okay, I'll use Aryans. And it's just the fact, they talk about natural law, that oil and water don't mix. And Jews and Germans don't mix. Those who want to bring them together, as some of these people want to do, are doing damage to us, and they should be looked at suspiciously for why they want to do this. Now, it's only because they think it's the only way, and they think it's the right way. They're not trying to hurt anything. They think it's helpful. But then can't go along with the fact that that is helpful. And this is where, again, you have to make up your mind where you stand on this. There can't be so many exceptions. Say, well, it's okay to do this, or it's okay to do a little bit of that, because that's how it all breaks down. So it seems like it's strict and too severe to most people, even to me lots of times. I think, wow, that's a... But then when you think about the whole problem and how long it's been going on and how much damage has been done, you know, then I change my mind and I say, no, you know, this has to be very strict, because we can't afford to be, have people coming moving in on our turf and undermining everything that we are and do. So, you can homogenize. I was thinking about the oil and water, and I was thinking about milk. Now, I have been able to buy raw milk for the last 6 weeks. I just get a gallon every 2 weeks. And boy, I've been making kefir with it. Is that wonderful? I had quit milk altogether, and now I'm drinking this milk that's full of probiotics and making a fermented product out of it, and using that all the time. And when they homogenize milk, that's what ruins it, and it's not healthy. It's not a healthy product anymore. And what it does is it binds the fat and the liquid or the water together in the milk. And they do it so that it won't separate, just for convenience sake. The pasteurizing is what damages the milk, but the homogenizing damages it too. And there's no reason to do it except so that the fat doesn't rise to the top and you have to shake your milk a little bit. It's just ridiculous. So, I take health very seriously. I've always been interested in health. So examples like this make a lot of sense to me, that you just can't mix things that nature has made, keep separate. Because nature does keep the fat and liquid or water separate, and you can't mix them. Unless you can mix them temporarily, shake it together, but it'll separate again. and because they're two different kind of things. So just a few words about Rodney Martin and me. All right. Oh, well, you know, it was not me who said that he graduated with, or he didn't graduate with Phi Beta Kappa. It was him who said that he did. He said that he did, and he said he graduated summa cum laude, and I wrote about that. Because I didn't believe it when I heard it. I didn't believe it. Why? Well, for one thing, he's never said it before. Now, he tells us he's 46 years old. I believe him. I believe a lot of things that he says. But if they don't add up for me, and as you know, in the post I wrote, I looked all that up to find out. And I found out that the school that he has said in the past that he went to, but it never came out of his own mouth, as far as I know, but it was in an interview that he disputes anyway, that said that about him, but like he gave them that information. But on his biographical things on Metapedia and on his website and so on, he doesn't mention anything about his education. Nothing. It seems kind of strange to me, for somebody who, like him, who presents himself the way he does. So, I want to know. I have two simple questions for him. Very simple. I'm not attacking him. I'm just asking him to answer two things about himself so that we can judge from some other things that he says, if they're true or not. So the first question is for Rodney Martin, and maybe he can bring this up in his debate on Tuesday. First thing is, did you attend college? Well, and if the answer is yes, then give the name and location of the institution you attended. Where? You know, that's all. Where is it? Where? What's the name of it, and where is it located? And number two, did you graduate from a college or university? And if the answer is yes, then give the name of the institution from which you graduated, because maybe he attended a college but he didn't graduate. But if he graduated, then we want to know where he graduated from and the year of graduation. But according to that newspaper interview, he graduated in 1993 from William Jewell. It says university, but it's really a college. It's called William Jewell College. And if that's it, that's all I want to know. And the fact is that I found out that that they don't have Phi Beta Kappa chapter there. And so they don't even have it now, let alone in 1993. And that if you graduate Phi Beta Kappa, it has to be from a school with a chapter. You know, the chapter has to put that distinction, that distinctive honor on you. It has to give it to you. So what does he do? He gets on his radio, he gets on David Bailey's radio program last Thursday night, and he says, David, what did I show you before we started this program? David says, yeah, you asked me to get on Skype video with you, and you showed me a couple things. Well, what were they? What was it? What was this little thing? And then Rodney comes in, yes, this little key. Anyway, Rodney is saying that he has this Phi Beta Kappa key, and he showed it to David Bailey on Skype video. And he also showed him his military uniform. Now, I've never questioned whether Rodney Martin was in the military. I believe him, you know, and I believe that he would have his military uniform. So he makes a big deal out of talking about the military uniform. And see, this is a trick. This is the trick that Rodney always does. He distracts. And so now he's making it into, it's a straw man too. He's making the military uniform into a straw man, and he's proving to David that he's got one. And so, as though I ever questioned that, I didn't. But he's not saying too much about the Phi Beta Kappa. He's not saying, he's not answering my question, which I had already asked publicly, as how he got it from William Jewell College, if they don't have it there, and so you know, how does that work and where did he graduate from somewhere else or whatever. He doesn't go into any of that. He doesn't answer it. Instead, he distracts about the military uniform and he says that he has this key. Well, as I have written since in the comments to that post, and as I was looking up this information, I noticed that there are places you just buy these things. You're supposed to have them, and I guess you're supposed to give the information for, you know, what you're, maybe you've got a certain number or something, I don't know. But, you can buy them or get one somewhere. And, so just showing, holding it up in his hand on Skype video to, David Bailey, who's his partner and his, director at the ANA, doesn't do it, you know. I mean, he's got to do better than that. So I came up with these two questions, about if he graduated, what college he graduated from, if he did graduate from college. And that should not be hard to answer. And from that, I can go on with the, planning out about the Phi Beta Kappa, which I don't believe there's any question about that, what I've mentioned about that. So now I'm going to move on, from all of that and from Rodney, and I really, indulging myself here on this program, but it hasn't taken too much time, and I'm in pretty good shape. So I want to, discuss, my statement that white people cannot unite under the concept of white. And I have been saying this, for a while, but a lot of what we've been seeing lately seems to me to be the evidence that it's just not a functioning proposition because of all the irreconcilable differences between the various rights, you know, this right and that right and another kind of right, let alone from the left, all the white people on the left and the various, all the various nationalities and ethnicities that we come from. That, the best that we can do is to have a supporting organization, you might say, various white nations can draw on and can ask for help and support from. And can show that they're trying to bring about a white society in their country. You know, I thought in connection with this, I wanted to say that I'm starting to believe that the United States of America has been a very, very bad proposition from the beginning for us. It has led to the worst kind of things, for white people. And it even interfered in the two world wars and brought about a final victory on the wrong side. You know, it brought about a final victory on the wrong side in these two gigantic world wars, interfered in that and, changed destiny, you might say. I think it's the colonizers that came here. They came from England and they were basically British. They should have kept it that way. If the United States had remained, whatever it would have been called, you know, wouldn't have been called that. But if it had remained totally British, I guess look at Britain today. I don't know, and it would at least have had a consistent way of a consistent policy about itself and an identity, you know, an English identity. But by wanting to settle the entire area of the United States and have people go out west and so on, they needed a lot of people, so everybody who came was welcome. And now we have a white population in the United States that's mixed ethnicity-wise and nationality-wise. And I think that this is a problem. And I'm going to go into that a little bit more in what I'm going to read about National Socialism. So maybe I'll do better if I wait on that to talk about it a little bit more then. Because a nation, all right, I'll just say this. Nationalism you have to have a homeland that you love and that you're defending, I think, to be successful with it. And to be able to keep other people out. How can you keep other people out when you don't have a particular identity, but you have a mixed identity? Then you don't have really the kind of a moral grounds, or not moral so much, but just the kind of actual racial grounds that you would have, that you do have when you have your own, when you have a nation of one ethnic nationality. So, and you say, well, we're this people, you know, this is our place, and we don't want you people here because you're not us, you're not like us. But when you already have a bunch of people, when you're already composed of people who have mixed among themselves, and they're, you know, they have married people outside of their own exact particular ethnic group, then that becomes not only acceptable, it even becomes a kind of a gold medal, you know, a medal of what's better. Isn't this better? All these people who are mixed European ethnicity, they tend to think that they it's wonderful because they're so European. They have different parts of Europe within them, and that they stand for Europe, and that's better than if they were all Swedish or totally Italian or what have you. See, they make that out to be better. But I say I have come more and more to the conclusion that it's not better at all, because they're not able to say, I want to live in a place with Swedes. And when we Swedes get together, we are of the same blood, the same ancestry and so on. And we therefore need to keep the rest of you out of our nation because you don't fit what we are. Now, I know people will say, well, you can enlarge your horizon, and you can call it, you can start by talking about Germanic people, and then you can go to Northern European people, and then you can go to Western European people, including the Southern people, and you can go to, and then, you know, the Slavs are separate from that, or then you can go to Pan-Europeanism, and include everyone and still say we want the other people out because they're not one of us. All right, I understand that argument, but I don't think it's, I think by that time you've already lost the game. I do. So, and we have. I believe that we have. so I'll, all right, I'm gonna move on to number three, or my third item. And I wanna, at this point, if anybody wants to call in to this chaotic program, it is, the number is 323-642-1206. Okay, I made the comment, that the more people that call themselves National Socialists, the less such persons there actually are. Well, this I wanted to talk about this in conjunction with, actually with, in a sense, but not only, but in a sense with the Daily Stormer, and who has been, you know, focused, who's been discussing over there, you know, are they too National Socialists? But also it's often been, who's a National Socialist? And all these people over there, more and more, are calling themselves National Socialists. And I want to comment first, though, to say that I think that the quality of the Daily Stormer has improved over the last week or so, and maybe a little bit longer than that. But I've noticed it since there was, since these things with, I guess since the article by Colin Liddell, and then more recently the one by Greg Johnson, that were highly critical of Daily Stormer and Andrew Anglin. So I think that had something to do with it. And then he took some of his sections away, the ones at the bottom, including Shill Watch and Art and Humor, and the, actually, I thought it was just four, but I think it was six of them. And I thought it looks better without them. And it, it seems to be, more focused. And I think the articles have been better and have been written better and seem to be more, tough and, direct and not so just bashing stuff, you know. I think maybe a conscious decision was made there. And I think it, anyway, that it was a good decision. It's a good decision to cut out some of those sections. And I think it was a good, good, and I think they're making maybe an effort to raise themselves up to a higher level. As I once not too long ago suggested that if it's named after the Der Stürmer, it should at least come up to the level of Der Stürmer. Yeah, Der Stürmer was known for being very, tough and in some way shockingly, disrespectful of Jews, but it was still, I think it was still, very good, it still had good arguments in it and so on. So, maybe that, so I want to just give a little credit where credit is due there, but at the same time, I want to say, people are calling Andrew Anglin the National Socialist. So I say, is Andrew Anglin a National Socialist? Well, I've never heard him say, I am a National Socialist. Or right, but I imagine what he would say is, I'm totally sympathetic with National Socialism and with German National Socialism as it was practiced and so on, but I don't think that he would say, I am, well, it would be in the sense that you can be a National Socialist, but that doesn't mean you can't be something else too, and this is where I think a lot of these people just want to think that they're National Socialists, want to say that, but they have their own idea about what it is. And of course, you can create any kind of National Socialism you want, but most of the time they're talking about Hitler, and they're talking about, they're using pictures and so on of Germany. So it's confusing because they tie it in with that. And so I wanted to discuss a little bit. What is a National Socialist? And, it's not just saying Sieg Heil, and it's not just looking at pictures and liking them, and it's not just writing on the internet like they do, because that makes it like a fantasy world, and which demands nothing of you. It demands nothing, you know, but real National Socialism asked a lot, or historical National Socialism, asked a lot from its adherents and from its members. So this is a difference. Is anything going to be asked of people as long as we're just on the internet? No. And so people ought to be more careful as to how they describe what they are and realize that it's, they can't just say, they can't just throw names around. I think it's cheapens the whole idea of National Socialism and the NSDAP, and it cheapens the whole Third Reich experience when it's overhyped, and people who don't even give a real name, or you don't have any idea who they are. They could be Jew trolls and so on, or Jew, you know, that infiltrator. Infiltration was that word I was trying to think of earlier. Oh, I was going to look at my mail, see if somebody is telling me that they can hear me, but I suppose I am. Okay, thanks Bob in DC, and thanks Mary for letting me know. Let me see what Mary says. Okay, temporary break. Well, my poor listeners, I feel sorry for them. the way I'm rambling on here. But now I'm going to talk about the NSDAP. What does it mean to be a National Socialist? And of course, I'm going back. So I want to go back to the German NSDAP that under Adolf Hitler and in the 20s, 30s, and early 40s. So I looked, one of the best things I found, just because there's not, I didn't have a lot of time, is something from Hanning Scott's site that he translated, and it's from the a political primer in English by Hans-Georg Memel. It was originally published in 1934. It was one of their party publications, and it was called Politische Fibel, which means political primer. And the edition he used is 1940, but so it had a little bit of change at the end. But I'm going to read some of this. It starts out by saying that a folk nation, see, because when we talk about National Socialism, we're talking about the folk, and people like that too. A lot of these people mention it, but a lot of them probably don't really think that through very, very carefully. And a folk nation, which is also a nation, is nation is in parentheses. The folk is the nation, is a community of human beings with the same descent, language, culture, history, and homeland, and the same political will. Well, that's a lot, but then it says that, shared ancestry is the most important characteristic. All right, so the folk is a community of blood and destiny. Those are, you know, words, but the important part is shared ancestry is the most important characteristic of those ones that were mentioned. After that, you have your shared language, you have your shared culture, your shared history, and your shared homeland, but they are not as important to it as ancestry. So, it says, we Germans are all related to each other. Now, I realized that they were building something here, and they were trying to reach all the Germans to understand how, you know, to grasp how to understand this and how to see themselves and all. You know, this is still has a propaganda aspect to it for sure. You know, they're in the bright sense though. They're educating and instructing the people. And this is what, since this was all directed at Germans, this is what the way they say it. But, this to me makes out that this is a problem for this mixed race people, even if they're mixed European race. You know, if you have a folk nation, whether it's Germany or whether it's Italy or whether it's you know, France or whether it's Russia, if you're half German and half Russian or something else, are you a part of that folk nation? Which, you know, where do you belong? See, and then we have people who are mixed far more than that. And then those are the people I think who are more likely to think in terms of Europe. Why? They would have to. So they think in terms of white and in terms of Europe. And see that, well, but European is not a folk. I don't think. It can't be. And it can't be a community of blood. You can stretch it and say that it is if you stretch out the idea of that there's such a thing as white blood. And I'm sure there's a lot of racialists, people who study race science, who can possibly show that in the way they study blood. But I'm just going to go on from here because even if they do show that, it's not the same thing in my mind. So it talks about language as being the most conspicuous sign of nationality. But as we know, people can learn your language and come into your country and speak your language perfectly. Particularly if they were born there, their parents came and then they were born there, but even if they just start out as a child in school, they speak it, excellently, but they're not a part of the folk, not according to National Socialism. And they say, they use the example here of the Jewish folk, who speak the language of whatever host nation they're in, but they're not, a part of that nation. Which, remember, the nation is the folk. And every true culture is bound to the folk, they say. So, and art is always rooted in folkdom. It is never international. So, you know, the more you move out from, you know, into international, that is, the more you move out from the one nation, the one folk, the more it becomes unfolk-like. I would say. I'm not going to read all of this. So then it says, every folk has a special settlement region, a homeland. It's one of the greatest tasks of every nation to adjust its living space to fit its population. Well, here they're going into why Germany needs more living space, which isn't really a part of what I want to get from this. And then they say, the next paragraph, an important characteristic is the common political will. So from, you can't, you know, says the awareness of belonging together, national consciousness is of decisive importance for a people. So a folk becomes a nation when it is animated by a unitary political will and unifies itself in a durable state. So by having the awareness of belonging together, you can build that, and which is also a national consciousness. You can build that political will, that common will. People will say, well, we don't have to be all in the same little area to feel that we belong together. Well, it makes it a whole lot easier and it's a whole lot more natural if you are, I think. But let's see what else it says here. Okay. In National Socialism, the folk is elevated to the central and most important value because in some places, sometimes the folk was considered low level, common folk and stuff, but it's just making the point that when you're a National Socialist or in National Socialism, that's done away with, and the folk is the central and most important value of the nation, not the least important. That was under the, was broken up into principalities and so on, and you had all those aristocrats ruling their own little territory there, and they were, they thought of the other folk is unimportant, you know, having little value, whereas they contained all the value and represented their principality. So this is a big change that's been taken, that's been forced into being from by National Socialism. Now, then it says the folk articulates itself organically into tribes, clans, gives the German names for that, and families. Now, this is important, or interesting, anyway. The family is the germ cell of the folk. It is as the smallest and most natural blood bond, one of the most important foundations of our entire life. So, you know, that's easy to understand. Every human being is decisively influenced in the house of his parents. Well, we know that's true. I don't think we can emphasize that enough. How we model our parents, whether you're a chicken, a little chick, or a little duck, or a little fish, or a human being, we do that. And they say that here that the Jew knows very well what he can, that he can only destroy the peoples among whom he lives if he destroys the family. And on the other hand, the soundness of our folk is only possible through a purposeful nurturing of the family. So, of course, a lot of families are, the parents are of mixed heritage. And so that's a part of their family. All right. While one understands by family only the nearest relatives, one calls the broader circle of blood relationship the clan. So in German prehistory, the clan played a major role. It will again acquire greater importance in the folkish state. It doesn't say any more than that about the clan, but that is your larger relatedness of, you know, what we call our, what we call that, the expanded family, all your relatives, and so on. And then the largest hereditary units within a people are the tribes, and they define themselves through a dialect. This word dialect comes in. Dialect is not something to be ashamed of. A dialect distinguishes you from the group what they're calling the tribe. It's a kind of a foreign name to me, but you know, from the area that you came from, distinguishes itself also along with dialect by through customs and usages and through a common homeland. So I like this part very much, as in Germany we are acquainted, for example, with the tribes of Lower Saxony, Franconia, Swabia, Bavaria, Saxony, Silesia, and so on. So this is the way you would look at the tribal or the part of Germany, you know, the area, which have distinct customs and distinct or somewhat distinct dialects. It's all German, but they speak it a little bit different way. They have a few words that others don't use and things like that. I don't know why they make such a big deal out of dialects not being High German or something. Somebody once said it's all High German. It just depends on where you come from. Anyway, it's not like bad vocabulary or, you know, like, you know, not being able to speak properly. But let's see what else is here. However great the differences between the particular German tribes may appear, the commonality which binds them all is greater by far. The tribes are only parts of the folk, a community of destiny. Once again, they say that. Folk and race are not the same. Boy, we've gone over this already in the past. Says here that folk is a political and cultural concept, and race is a concept of biology and natural science. Yeah, that's not hard for white nationalists to accept. Race is the biology, and folk, though, is the political and cultural. The folk is the bond of, the race, by contrast, is not a political community, but the eternal spring from which the people derive its strength. So, the race is that which we all draw from, the eternal spring, but it's not the political community. And that might have some importance there when we try to make race the folk. You know, if we try to make race meaning that, or race into, the most important thing that, which is all we need to define ourselves by. But we need more than that for a real sense of identity with our own people. It says that the folk is the only political community. Everything we do should be for the benefit of the German folk. We struggle and sacrifice for our folk. Well, you have to have this. See, to make this work, to make it mean enough to you, to care enough about it, it has to touch you as your ancestry, you know, as deeply as your ancestry and your own people, that you come from, you can connect with that. And of course the idea of blood fits in with that. So if it's, if you can't connect that closely to it, it gets more and more abstract. And as it gets more and more abstract, it's easier to allow your commitment to weaken, because you don't feel that you are as necessary to it as because other people can take your place. There's so many more people, such a larger group of people for doing this work, and let them do it, kind of. Now, there's a little bit more here. It says the Jews are a folk, not a race. They're often portrayed as a race in order to emphasize their distinctness. They are a folk completely alien to us Germans, with an entirely different racial composition. Now, if you're not anti-Jewish, he said, then it says, we National Socialists are anti-Semites. You know, if you're not an anti-Semite, if you don't want to be an anti-Semite, well, you can't be a National Socialist. And that's why those don't want to be white nationalists move away from National Socialism, don't like it for a lot of reasons, but one of the big reasons is that it is anti-Semitic, and they don't want to be anti-Semites. So we have a whole lot of pro-white people. They call themselves white nationalists, too. I don't know anybody who really objects to that title, to that name, amongst these people. But they want to judge people individually, and they know a lot of Jews, or some Jews, and they like them. They're not going to say we can't have any Jews. But in National Socialism, it's strictly, and I think it should always be seen that way, strictly anti-Jewish. And it says that a baptized Jew remains racially and folkishly still a Jew. We are likewise not gutter anti-Semites, nor are we strictly anti-Semites, only anti-Semites. We are adversaries of the Jews for the following reasons. That is, there are reasons, and they're going to give two reasons here, for why we are anti-Semitic, not just because we hate Jews for no reason, right? There's reasons. So reason number one is Jewry is a foreign folk. And see, in National Socialism, you don't want anything foreign. But think about that. The Jew is of a completely different descent, alien blood. He's a different political will. He's always, in the first place, a Jew. And then, if it's a benefit to him, he'll be a German, English, French, etc. And we know that. Boy, we know that from experience. And also that Jewry considers itself a chosen people and strives for world power. The second reason is that the Jew is a parasite, a sponger. He always corrupts the folk in which he dwells, deliberately destroys the host people, and he destroys their basic prerequisites for life. Jewry is the ferment of decomposition, the force of destruction. The Jew knows very well how to camouflage himself and to adapt himself to the people among whom he dwells. He systematically poisons every healthy folk, for in an unhealthy folk, the Jewish sponger thrives better. You know, it's coming into my mind, so I think I better say it right now or I'll forget it, this is another reason why smaller is better, because when you're smaller, you're able to see the work of the Jew in your midst. But when you become a part of a larger organization, the larger and larger it gets, like European versus national, then the Jew can get in there so much more easily, and people are not watching out because there's so many different people. You see, there's a lot of different people, and you're used to differences. And there's nothing, you know, they're all acceptable. So what it would take would be, you know, when you think, well, we didn't want things so small, but then you have to be able to, have a larger unified, organization, but the small, down to the smallest group has to have self, quite a bit of self-rule and self, you know, self-governing and self-decision-making, and so on. And so that you, relate to your smaller group, and then you're more aware of what's going on in that smaller group. And this, parasite can't get in there nearly as easily. Shouldn't be able to at all. So it says, he prevailed not because of his greater ability, since you're talking about the Jew. The Jew prevailed not because of his greater ability, but as a consequence of his brazenness, and also brutality and lack of conscience. For they know the Jew. These people knew the Jew. The Jew ruled the German people, period. The Jew ruled the German people. Now, so it says, you know, it ends up, National Socialism organizes the unified defense of the German nation. So that's how you see National Socialism, as that which organizes the defense of your nation. Now, people would have to tell me how this would work and how it would be done for, say, a unified Europe or something like that. And they would have to work it out, too, not just say, well, we could do this, this, and this. You know, it would have to be worked out in detail how the defense of the nations, each nation, against the Jew and other in other invaders and enemies would be undertaken or would work. So I will have a little bit here on a few of the points from the 25 points of the NSDAP. I'm still trying to get at what you have to understand and what you have to agree to in order to be a National Socialist of the Third Reich type. Again, if people want to be have their own thing and call it National Socialism, I think they should come up with a different name, truthfully. But they would need to distinguish that it's not the Hitler National Socialism, or it's not the German or Third Reich National Socialism. It's a little bit different. But the Third Reich National Socialism, amongst its 25 points, it has number one. I'm taking the very first one, so this is very important, you know, because I think the most important ones are in the top. They say, we demand the union of all Germans in a great Germany on the basis of the principle of self-determination of all peoples. So this would be whatever people you were, whatever your nationality was, you know, you would unite with your own people for self-determination. And then I skipped two and three, but number four is only those who are our fellow countrymen can become citizens. Only those who have German blood, regardless of creed, can be our countrymen. Hence, no Jew can be a countryman. But, you know, I read into this because of our current situation. Our fellow countrymen, only our fellow countrymen, only those with German blood in this case. Now, what if you are half German and half something else? How does that work? I would say it doesn't work. It doesn't really work. So that's just a question that I bring up. Number five is those who are not citizens must live in Germany as foreigners, and must be subject to the law of aliens. Well, in other words, if you're not of German blood, but this is kind of thinking in terms of those who are not at all of German blood. They're thinking of real foreigners and Jews and so on, or, you know, non-Europeans and things like that. But if you are mixed European, I suppose you could, if you were accepted, say, let's just say in Germany, but you would be, it would be noted that you were not 100%. And so that would just be something that everybody should know, or that, you know, that might might make a difference as far as your holding offices or, you know, things like that. So now, number six, the right to choose the government and determine the laws of the state shall belong only to citizens. We there, and the citizens have to be of the blood of the nation. We therefore demand that no public office of whatever nature, whether in the central government, the province, or the municipality, shall be held by anyone who is not a citizen. And when they say citizen, then that, as I already said, that already point includes that you have to be of that blood. Then number eight, any further immigration of non-Germans must be prevented. So we, yeah, so at this point now we have people who are not Germans, but we're not going to allow any more in. And then we've got our laws to deal with the ones that are here. Nine, all citizens must possess equal rights and duties. Well, I like that because being a citizen doesn't just give you rights, but it also gives you duties. And in, of course, amongst the Germans, it's always, the duties are always right up there with whatever rights you have. Everybody's got duties. And the last one I'm going to, that I thought was worth mentioning here is number 10. The first duty of every citizen must be to work. You just stop right there, mentally or physically. No individual shall do any work that offends against the interest of the community to the benefit of all. Well, that's nice to have it there, but the idea is every citizen has to work. So it's not, you're not going to have people, you're not going to bring people into your country to do the work for you. No, you're only going to have the people who are of the blood of that, of your nation or folk, and you're all going to work. You're going to work. That's one thing I've always liked about, and you know, it's very, it's also, very natural to me to think this way, and I've always been able to agree to the fact that you want to do your own work. And you don't want to bring, foreign people in or people that aren't like you to do the work. I've never been comfortable with that. So, that's, a real part of, German nationalist thinking, whether it's national socialism or not, I think. Now, I know that I might seem, to be extreme and because it fits me, I can say these things and, you know, if it doesn't fit other people, well, too bad. But this is, I think we get too far away from these very strict ideas. And it when we allow ourselves to move away from it, then we move further and further away and we make more and more exceptions. And I'm going back just before I say goodbye to you all here to that the United States has done a great disservice to just the whole formation of the United States, I think has done a disservice to the white race in that it has created this nation of what's called the melting pot and where people felt totally comfortable and right and in marrying other Europeans, even some that are pretty far different from the one, the kind that they are, not even close, but very different. Having these children and then their children doing it too, till you get, people with a whole lot of different, ethnicities in them. And we're seeing this as very good. There's nothing, there's a lot that can be said about that, which I'm not prepared to do here, and I don't even know, whether it's true or not, or holds up or not. It's just opinions, maybe. But when it comes to then figuring out where you belong, you know, what clan, what tribe, etc. Well, let alone what folk, you can't do it. So you have, you're a different type. You're a different type, and that hasn't happened so much yet in Europe. The problem in Europe has been more the non-whites moving in, but there is a big problem, and I'm going to say talk about that on Monday with people with the European Union allowing free movement throughout Europe for all European movement union members. Now you can see right there where that whole problem that I've been talking about here comes in. And so you've got people from, and it's all one way, you know, it's mostly from Eastern Europe into Western Europe. And you've got a lot of, Poles were some of the first ones that were joined the European Union. And so they, Poles and Czechs, and so they did a lot of, moving to, Britain, largely in Italy and other places, and, Poles in Germany too, and then all these nations were starting, and now a lot of these, poorer nations in the Balkans are just waiting, or some of them have just gotten approved, and right away, Romania, this influx into Western Europe of the lowest, income people there, the Roma and, others, you know, start moving right away into Western Europe. And, it's a big strain on Western Europe, but they've got these laws and it's like, undemocratic and worse if you, complain about that, because the idea is that we're all the same. We're all alike. We're all European. You see, and this is where the whole problem comes in. When you start these things, you just have people that are pretty compatible, moving around. And then later, as you enlarge it and you include more and more, which is what always seems to happen, then it brings up some real difficulties. And we're having those difficulties now. These peoples are causing havoc. And what they're doing is they don't care about Europe, and they don't care about European people. All they care about is making a little more money or getting on that welfare train that they can get on in the Western European countries, and taking advantage of it. So here you have people who are we're told by those who have the broadest perspective or understanding on who is white. And who are all the same, and who are our comrades and compatriots and so on. The broadest understanding of that, including all of Europe, the Slav lands and, other Eastern European peoples with the Germanics and the Latins and so on, who have been close and functioning with one another, more closely for many, many centuries and have a lot in common. So, this is showing that people are just out for what they can get. It's not about we love all our white people. These people are not motivated by that at all. And I don't know what kind of an organization would be created by white, what should we call, white nationalists or pan-Aryans, but it would have to be pretty darn good. And from what I've seen of what the people, the organizations and so on, they're not up to it. They wouldn't be able to do it. Very, very few people are of the caliber of what the national NSDAP was created by in those days. It's just what came together at that time. But truly, I think that the German people are not only the heart of Europe, they are the best of Europe. And, I've gotten up the courage to say that, that came out pretty well. Without being right away saying, oh, well, of course, I don't really mean blah, 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 and, you know, worrying about it and making excuses for myself. But that is true. And we have to have a genuine something of a hierarchy or an order where the best are recognized and going on down the line. So that's my problem with those are the things that I think about and that I think are important. And I'm more than happy for, oh, somebody is here. Sorry. Okay. I'm answering the call. Hello there.
Yes, hello. Hello, Carolyn. I just wanted to point out, and it's not in deference to what you're saying, but the only reason I brought up the Slav issue is because it's so important. It's overriding in importance last week, and it's going to be something that's a project ongoing that I'm going to concentrate on. But as far as particularizing, like between Germans, French, English, Austrians even, as a subset of Germany, and things like that, these are all important questions, but the number one is the enemy number one, the Jew. And we will get no place until the Jew is out of the mix, no matter what we talk about. Right now we're commiserating over things that are important, but the number one is to eliminate the Jew from our own philosophy, from our Volk. Whatever our particular background is, if the Jew
is
around,
he will. Well, that's what I say. If we're identified with our own Volk, we have a lot better chance of eliminating the Jew from that group than we do from this whole white European continent.
Yeah, I agree. But I'm saying that there's one commonality, and that is the Jewish enemy
number one
to all.
Right. And the name of this thing I just read, go ahead. Well, wait a minute. The name of this thing I just read is Basic Doctrine of the NSDAP Regarding Jews. So, I mean, you know, it has to be the Jews, but the fact is, you said you were going to focus on the Slavic thing, and now you're saying it's the Jews. Well, you've been saying that all along. So what are you doing about the Jews?
Well, my point is that the only reason I am going to focus on the Slav thing, because it's a particular issue underneath the rest, which has been more divisive than all the others. That's the only reason. But let me go back. The Jewish question must be the one that's resolved first before we even, you know, this is like a background thing for me. This is a thing I'm doing to the side. But the Jewish question has to be resolved first, because if it's still there, if that problem is still there, it doesn't matter. We can have success after success, and we will lose ground every time because the Jew will figure out a way to wangle it against us. That's what they do. They're very good at it. But it's pretty simple stuff. We must cast the way I put it is, we must cast the kite Jew from our presence and all Jews from our realms. That's all there is to it. There is no other, you know, if we can't
do
that.
Well, you know, Adolf Hitler was saying that back then, and you have a problem with the way he went about things. But, you know, it's easy to say that, Bob.
Yeah.
You know, I don't disagree with you at all. But you say, we got to do this first. Well, what's the plan?
Well, that's the point. What is the plan? But my point is, stay on focus. You see, what's happening to these other people, and when you're rightly bringing them up, is just for Rodney Martin to be in some kind of an interview or a back and forth with the Jew is wrong. That's what I mean when we say.
I think there's no benefit to it. There's nothing to talk about.
It's antithetical. I mean, it's like making a deal with botulism. You know, you don't make a deal. You don't negotiate with botulism. You kill it, or you eliminate it from your presence. And that's the way I look at the Jews. I don't think what they say the Germans did is necessarily the thing to do. I think Birobidzhan is big enough for all of them. But that's my point, is we must stay focused on that. And when somebody gets off track and starts even talking to them at that level, outside of a pragmatic day-to-day business thing, you can't help. Okay, that's understood. But in a political or philosophical sense, to have anything to do with these people is insane. It's literally, from a natural law perspective, insane.
Okay. Well, all right. So anything else you want to say before we say goodnight?
No, I just wanted to point that out. And I just wanted to point that out again. And I'm sure you're particularizing now just because that's what the show is about. But, we can never lose sight of the enemy number one.
No, that's right. Well, I totally agree. All right. Well, thanks, Bob. Thanks for calling. You're a good one for being willing to pick up the phone and call, or however you do it. Click on Skype or whatever. All right. That was Bob from D.C., ladies and gentlemen. And I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm going to be saying goodbye for this Saturday afternoon program on October 11th, 2014. And join me again on Monday at 8 p.m. Central. Bye now.